He entered, gave one look, and stood silent as the rest. "When did this change take place?" said he in a low whisper to Miss Ophelia. "About the turn of the night," was the reply. Marie, roused by the entrance of the doctor, appeared hurriedly from the next room. "Augustine, cousin! Oh, what?" she hurriedly began. "Hush!" said St. Clair hoarsely. "She is dying." Mammy heard the words and flew to awaken the servants. The house was soon roused, lights were seen, footsteps heard, anxious faces thronged the veranda, and looked tearfully through the glass doors. But St. Clair heard and said nothing. He saw only that look on the face of the little sleeper. "Oh, if she would only wake and speak once more," he said, and stooping over her, he spoke in her ear. "Eva, darling." The large blue eyes unclosed, a smile passed over her face. She tried to raise her head and to speak. "Do you know me, Eva?" "Dear Papa," said the child with a last effort, throwing her arms about his neck. In a moment they drooped again, and as St. Clair raised his head, he saw a spasm of mortal agony pass over the face. She struggled for breath and threw up her little hands. "Oh, God, this is dreadful," he said, turning away in agony, and wringing Tom's hands, scarce conscious what he was doing. "Oh, Tom, my boy, it is killing me." Tom had his master's hands between his own, and with tears streaming down his dark cheeks, looked up for help where he had always been used to look. "Pray that this may be cut short," said St. Clair. "This wrings my heart." "Oh, bless the Lord. It's over. It's over, dear master," said Tom. "Look at her." The child lay panting on her pillows, as one exhausted, the large clear eyes rolled up and fixed. Ah, what said those eyes that spoke so much of heaven? Earth was past, and earthly pain. But so solemn, so mysterious was the triumphant brightness of that face, that it checked even the sobs of sorrow. They pressed around her in breathless stillness. "Eva," said St. Clair gently. She did not hear. "Oh, Eva, tell us what you see. What is it?" said her father. A bright, glorious smile passed over her face, and she said, brokenly, "Oh, love, joy, peace." Gave one sigh and passed from death unto life. Farewell, beloved child. The bright eternal doors have closed after thee. We shall see thy sweet face no more. Oh, woe for them who watched thy entrance into heaven, when they shall wake and find only the cold grey sky of daily life, and thou gone forever. Chapter 27. This is the last of Earth. The statuettes and pictures in Eva's room were shrouded in white napkins, and only hushed breathings and muffled footfalls were heard there, and the light stole in solemnly through windows partially darkened by closed blinds. The bed was draped in white, and there, beneath the drooping angel figure, lay a little sleeping form. Sleeping, never to waken. There she lay, robed in one of the simple white dresses she had been wont to wear when living. The rose-colored light through the curtains cast over the icy coldness of death a warm glow. The heavy eyelashes drooped softly on the pure cheek. The head was turned a little to one side, as if in natural sleep, but there was diffused over every lineament of the face that high celestial expression, that mingling of rapture and repose, which showed it was no earthly or temporary sleep, but the long, sacred rest which he giveth to his beloved. There is no death to such as thou, dear Eva, neither darkness nor shadow of death, only such a bright fading as when the morning star fades in the golden dawn. Thine is the victory without the battle, the crown without the conflict. So did St. Clair think, as with folded arms he stood there gazing. Ah, who shall say what he did think? For from the hour that voices had said in the dying chamber, she is gone. It had been all a dreary mist, a heavy dimness of anguish. He had heard voices around him. He had had questions asked and answered them. They had asked him when he would have the funeral and where they should lay her, and he had answered impatiently that he cared not. Adolf and Rosa had arranged the chamber, volatile, fickle, and childish as they generally were. They were soft-hearted and full of feeling, and while Miss Ophelia presided over the general details of order and neatness, it was their hands that added those soft poetic touches to the arrangements that took from the death-room the grim and ghastly air which too often marks a New England funeral. There were still flowers on the shelves, all white, delicate and fragrant, with graceful drooping leaves. Eva's little table, covered with white, bore on it her favorite vase, with a single white moss rosebud in it. The folds of the drapery, the fall of the curtains, had been arranged and rearranged by Adolf and Rosa, with that nicety of eye which characterizes their race. Even now, while St. Clair stood there thinking, little Rosa tripped softly into the chamber with a basket of white flowers. She stepped back when she saw St. Clair, and stopped respectfully. But seeing that he did not observe her, she came forward to place them around the dead. St. Clair saw her, as in a dream, while she placed in the small hands a fair cape jessamine, and with admirable taste disposed other flowers around the couch. The door opened again, and Topsy, her eyes swelled with crying, appeared, holding something under her apron. Rosa made a quick, forbidding gesture, but she took a step into the room. "You must go out," said Rosa in a sharp, positive whisper. "You haven't any business here."
"Oh, do let me. I brought a flower. Such a pretty one," said Topsy, holding up a half-blown tea rosebud. "Do let me put just one there."
"Get along," said Rosa, more decidedly. "Let her stay," said St. Clair, suddenly stamping his foot. "She shall come." Rosa suddenly retreated, and Topsy came forward and laid her offering at the feet of the corpse. Then suddenly, with a wild and bitter cry, she threw herself on the floor alongside the bed and wept and moaned aloud. Miss Ophelia hastened into the room and tried to raise and silence her, but in vain.
"Oh, Miss Eva, oh, Miss Eva, I wish I's dead too, I do."
There was a piercing wildness in the cry. The blood flushed into St. Clair's white, marble-like face, and the first tears he had shed since Eva died stood in his eyes. "Get up, child," said Miss Ophelia in a softened voice. "Don't cry so. Miss Eva is gone to heaven. She is an angel."
"But I can't see her," said Topsy. "I never shall see her."
And she sobbed again. They all stood a moment in silence.
"She said she loved me,"
said Topsy.
"She did. Oh, dear. Oh, dear. There ain't nobody left now. There ain't."
"That is true enough," said St. Clair. "But do," he said to Miss Ophelia, "see if you can't comfort the poor creature."
"I just wish I had never been born," said Topsy. "I didn't want to be born, no ways, and I don't see no use on it."
Miss Ophelia raised her gently but firmly and took her from the room. But as she did so, some tears fell from her eyes.
"Topsy, you poor child," she said, as she led her into her room. "Don't give up.
I can love you, though I am not like that dear little child. I hope I've learnt something of the love of Christ from her. I can love you. I do, and I'll try to help you to grow up a good Christian girl." Miss Ophelia's voice was more than her words, and more than that were the honest tears that fell down her face. From that hour she acquired an influence over the mind of the destitute child that she never lost. "Oh, my Eva, whose little hour on earth did so much of good," thought St. Clair. "What account have I to give for my long years?" There were for a while soft whisperings and footfalls in the chamber, as one after another stole in to look at the dead, and then came the little coffin, and then there was a funeral, and carriages drove to the door, and strangers came and were seated, and there were white scarves and ribbons and crape bands and mourners dressed in black crape, and there were words read from the Bible and prayers offered, and St. Clair lived and walked and moved as one who has shed every tear. To the last he saw only one thing, that golden head in the coffin. But then he saw the cloth spread over it, the lid of the coffin closed, and he walked, when he was put beside the others, down to a little place at the bottom of the garden. And there by the mossy seat, where she and Tom had talked and sung and read so often, was the little grave. St. Clair stood beside it, looked vacantly down. He saw them lower the little coffin. He heard dimly the solemn words, "I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live." And as the earth was cast in and filled up the little grave, he could not realize that it was his Eva that they were hiding from his sight. Nor was it. Not Eva, but only the frail seed of that bright immortal form, with which she shall yet come forth in the day of the Lord Jesus. And then all were gone. And the mourners went back to the place which should know her no more, and Marie's room was darkened, and she lay on the bed sobbing and moaning in uncontrollable grief, and calling every moment for the attentions of all her servants. Of course, they had no time to cry. Why should they? The grief was her grief, and she was fully convinced that nobody on earth did, could, or would feel it as she did. St. Clair did not shed a tear, she said. He didn't sympathize with her. It was perfectly wonderful to think how hard-hearted and unfeeling he was, when he must know how she suffered. So much are people the slave of their eye and ear, that many of the servants really thought that Mrs. was the principal sufferer in the case, especially as Marie began to have hysterical spasms, and sent for the doctor and at last declared herself dying. And in the running and scampering and bringing up hot bottles and heating up flannels and chaffing and fussing that ensued, there was quite a diversion. Tom, however, had a feeling at his own heart that drew him to his master. He followed him wherever he walked, wistfully and sadly, and when he saw him sitting so pale and quiet in Eva's room, holding before his eyes her little open Bible, though seeing no letter or word of what was in it, there was more sorrow to Tom in that still fixed tearless eye than in all Marie's moans and lamentations. In a few days the St. Clair family were back again in the city, Augustine with the restlessness of grief, longing for another scene, to change the current of his thoughts. So they left the house and garden with its little grave and came back to New Orleans. And St. Clair walked the streets busily and strove to fill up the chasm in his heart with hurry and bustle and change of place, and people who saw him in the street or met him at the café knew of his loss only by the weed on his hat. For there he was, smiling and talking and reading the newspaper and speculating on politics and attending to business matters, and who could see that all this smiling outside was but a hollowed shell over a heart that was a dark and silent sepulchre? "Mr. St. Clair is a singular man," said Marie to Miss Ophelia, in a complaining tone. "I used to think if there was anything in the world he did love, it was our dear little Eva. But he seems to be forgetting her very easily. I cannot ever get him to talk about her. I really did think he would show more feeling." "Still waters run deepest," they used to tell me," said Miss Ophelia, oracularly. "Oh, I don't believe in such things. It's all talk. If people have feeling, they will show it. They can't help it. But then it's a great misfortune to have feeling. I'd rather have been made like St. Clair. My feelings prey upon me so." "Sure, missus, Master St. Clair is getting thin as a shader." "They say he don't ever eat nothing," said Mammy. "I know he don't forget Miss Eva. I know there couldn't nobody, dear little blessed creature," she added, wiping her eyes. "Well, at all events, he has no consideration for me," said Marie. "He hasn't spoken one word of sympathy, and he must know how much more a mother feels than any man can." "The heart knoweth its own bitterness," said Miss Ophelia gravely. "That's just what I think. I know just what I feel. Nobody else seems to. Eva used to, but she is gone." And Marie lay back on her lounge and began to sob disconsolately. Marie was one of those unfortunately constituted mortals, in whose eyes whatever is lost and gone assumes a value which it never had in possession. Whatever she had, she seemed to survey only to pick flaws in it, but once fairly away, there was no end to her valuation of it. While this conversation was taking place in the parlor, another was going on in St. Clair's library. Tom, who was always uneasily following his master about, had seen him go into his library some hours before, and after vainly waiting for him to come out, determined at last to make an errand in. He entered softly. St. Clair lay on his lounge, at the further end of the room. He was lying on his face with Eva's Bible open before him, at a little distance. Tom walked up and stood by the sofa. He hesitated, and while he was hesitating, St. Clair suddenly raised himself up. The honest face so full of grief, and with such an imploring expression of affection and sympathy, struck his master. He laid his hand on Tom's and bowed down his forehead on it. "Oh, Tom, my boy, the whole world is as empty as an eggshell." "I know it, massa, I know it," said Tom. "But oh, if massa could only look up where our dear Miss Eva is, up to the dear Lord Jesus." "Oh, Tom, I do look up. But the trouble is, I don't see anything. When I do, I wish I could." Tom sighed heavily.
"Seems to be given to children and poor honest fellows like you, to see what we can't," said St. Clair. "How comes it?"
"Thou hast hid from the wise and prudent and revealed unto babes," murmured Tom. "Even so, father, for so it seemed good in thy sight."
"Tom, I don't believe it. I can't believe it. I've got the habit of doubting," said St. Clair. "I want to believe this Bible, and I can't."
"Dear massa, pray to the good Lord."
"Lord, I believe, help thou my unbelief." "Who knows about anything?" said St. Clair, his eyes wandering dreamily and speaking to himself. Was all that beautiful love and faith only one of the ever-shifting phases of human feeling, having nothing real to rest on,
passing away with a little breath. And is there no more Eva, no heaven, no Christ, nothing?
Oh, dear Massa, there is. I know it, I'm sure of it, said Tom,
falling on his knees. Do, dear Massa, believe it.
How do you know there's any Christ, Tom? You never saw the Lord.
Felt him in my soul, Massa. Feel him now. Oh, Massa, when I was sold away from my old woman and the children, I was just almost broke up. I felt as if there weren't nothing left.
And then the good Lord, he stood by me and he says, fear not, Tom. And he brings light and joy in a poor fellow's soul, makes all peace. And I so happy and loves everybody and feeling willing just to be the Lord's and have the Lord's will done and be put just where the Lord wants to put me. I know it couldn't come from me, because I was poor, complaining creature. It comes from the Lord, and I know he's willing to do it for Massa.
Tom spoke with fast-running tears and choking voice. St. Clair leaned his head on his shoulder and wrung the hard, faithful black hand.
Tom, you love me, he said.
I was willing to lay down my life this blessed day to see Massa a Christian.
Poor, foolish boy, said St. Clair, half raising himself. I'm not worth the love of one good, honest heart like yours.
Oh, Massa, dearest, more than me loves you. The blessed Lord Jesus loves you.
How do you know that, Tom? Said St. Clair.
Feels it in my soul, oh, Massa, the love of Christ that passes knowledge.
Singular, said St. Clair, turning away, that the story of a man that lived and died 1800 years ago can affect people so yet.
But he was no man, he added suddenly. No man ever had such long and living power. Ah, that I could believe what my mother taught me and pray, as I did when I was a boy.
If Massa pleases, said Tom, Miss Eva used to read this so beautifully. I wish Massa'd be so good as read it. Don't get no reading hardly now, Miss Eva's gone.
The chapter was the 11th of John. The touching account of the raising of Lazarus. St. Clair read it aloud, often pausing to wrestle down feelings which were roused by the pathos of the story. Tom knelt before him with clasped hands and with an absorbed expression of love, trust, adoration on his quiet face.
Tom, said his master, this is all real to you.
I can just fairly see it, Massa, said Tom.
I wish I had your eyes, Tom.
I wish to the dear Lord, Massa had. But, Tom, you know that I have a great deal more knowledge than you, that if I should tell you that I don't believe this Bible—
Oh, Massa, said Tom, holding up his hands with a depreciating gesture. Wouldn't it shake your faith some, Tom?
Not a grain, said Tom.
Why, Tom, you must know I know the most.
Oh, Massa, haven't you just read how he hides from the wise and the prudent and reveals unto babes?
But Massa wasn't in earnest for certain now, said Tom anxiously.
No, Tom, I was not. I don't disbelieve, and I think there is reason to believe. And still I don't.
It's a troublesome bad habit I've got, Tom.
If Massa would only pray.
How do you know I don't, Tom? Does Massa?
I would, Tom, if there was anybody there when I pray. But it's all speaking unto nothing when I do.
But come, Tom, you pray now. Show me how.
Tom's heart was full. He poured it out in prayer, like waters that had been long suppressed. One thing was plain enough, Tom thought. There was somebody to hear, whether there were or not. In fact, St. Clair felt himself borne on the tide of his faith and feeling, almost to the gates of that heaven he seemed so vividly to conceive,
seemed to bring him nearer to Eva. Thank you, my boy, said St. Clair, when Tom rose. I like to hear you, Tom. But go now, and leave me alone. Some other time I'll talk more.
Tom silently left the room. Chapter 28. Reunion. Week after week glided away in the St. Clair mansion, and the waves of life settled back to their usual flow, where that little bark had gone down. For how imperiously, how coolly, in disregard of all one's feeling, does the hard, cold, uninteresting course of daily realities move on? Still must we eat and drink and sleep and wake again. Still bargain, buy, sell, ask and answer questions. Pursue, in short, a thousand shadows, though all interest in them be over, the cold mechanical habit of living remaining, after all vital interest in it has fled. All the interests and hopes of St. Clair's life had unconsciously wound themselves around this child. It was for Eva that he had managed his property. It was for Eva that he had planned the disposal of his time, and to do this and that for Eva, to buy, improve, alter, and arrange, or dispose something for her, had been so long his habit that now she was gone. There seemed nothing to be thought of, and nothing to be done. True, there was another life, a life which once believed in stands as a solemn, significant figure before the otherwise unmeaning ciphers of time, changing them to orders of mysterious, untold value. St. Clair knew this well, and often in many a weary hour, he heard that slender, childish voice calling him to the skies, and saw that little hand pointing to him the way of life. But a heavy lethargy of sorrow lay on him. He could not arise. He had one of those natures which could better and more clearly conceive of religious things from its own perceptions and instincts than many a matter-of-fact and practical Christian. The gift to appreciate and the sense to feel the finer shades and relations of moral things seems an attribute of those whose whole life shows a careless disregard of them. Hence Moore, Byron, Goethe often speak words more wisely descriptive of the true religious sentiment than another man, whose whole life is governed by it. In such minds, disregard of religion is a more fearful treason, a more deadly sin. St. Clair had never pretended to govern himself by any religious obligation, and a certain fineness of nature gave him such an instinctive view of the extent of the requirements of Christianity that he shrank, by anticipation, from what he felt would be the exactions of his own conscience, if he once did resolve to assume them. For so inconsistent is human nature, especially in the ideal, that not to undertake a thing at all seems better than to undertake and come short. Still, St. Clair was, in many respects, another man. He read his little Eva's Bible seriously and honestly. He thought more soberly and practically of his relations to his servants, enough to make him extremely dissatisfied with both his past and present course. And one thing he did, soon after his return to New Orleans, and that was to commence the legal steps necessary to Tom's emancipation, which was to be perfected as soon as he could get through the necessary formalities. Meantime, he attached himself to Tom more and more every day. In all the wide world, there was nothing that seemed to remind him so much of Eva, and he would insist on keeping him constantly about him, and fastidious and unapproachable as he was with regard to his deeper feelings, he almost thought aloud to Tom. Nor would anyone have wondered at it, who had seen the expression of affection and devotion with which Tom continually followed his young master. "Well, Tom," said St. Clair, the day after he had commenced the legal formalities for his enfranchisement, "I'm going to make a free man of you. So have your trunk packed, and get ready to set out for Kentuck." The sudden light of joy that shone in Tom's face as he raised his hands to heaven, his emphatic, "Bless the Lord!" rather discomposed St. Clair. He did not like it that Tom should be so ready to leave him. "You haven't had such very bad times here, that you need to be in such rapture, Tom," he said dryly. "No, no, massa, tain't that. It's being a free man, that's what I'm joying for." "Why, Tom, don't you think for your own part you've been better off than to be free?" "No, indeed, Master St. Clair," said Tom with a flash of energy. "No, indeed. Why, Tom, you couldn't possibly have earned by your work such clothes and such living as I have given you." "Knows all that, Master St. Clair. Master's been too good. But, Master, I'd rather have poor clothes, poor house, poor everything, and have 'em mine, than have the best and have 'em any man's else's. I had so, Master. I think it's nature, Master."
"I suppose so, Tom. And you'll be going off and leaving me in a month or so," he added, rather disconcertedly. "Though why you shouldn't, no mortal knows," he said in a gayer tone, and getting up he began to walk the floor. "Not while Massa is in trouble," said Tom. "I'll stay with Massa as long as he wants me, so I can be any use."
"Not while I'm in trouble, Tom?" said St. Clair, looking sadly out of the window. "And when will my trouble be over?"
"When Massa St. Clair's a Christian," said Tom.
"And you really mean to stay by till that day comes," said St. Clair, half-smiling as he turned from the window and laid his hand on Tom's shoulder. "Ah, Tom, you soft, silly boy. I won't keep you till that day. Go home to your wife and children, and give my love to all." "I's faith to believe that day will come," said Tom earnestly, and with tears in his eyes. "The Lord has a work for Massa."
"A work, eh?" said St. Clair. "Well, now, Tom, give me your views on what sort of work it is. Let's hear."
"Why, even a poor fella like me has a work from the Lord. And Massa St. Clair, that has learning and riches and friends, how much he might do for the Lord."
"Tom, you seem to think the Lord needs a great deal done for him," said St. Clair, smiling.
"We does for the Lord when we does for his critters," said Tom.
"Good theology, Tom. Better than Dr. B. preaches, I dare swear," said St. Clair. The conversation was here interrupted by the announcement of some visitors. Marie St. Clair felt the loss of Eva as deeply as she could feel anything, and as she was a woman that had a great faculty of making everybody unhappy when she was, her immediate attendants had still stronger reason to regret the loss of their young mistress, whose winning ways and gentle intercessions had so often been a shield to them from the tyrannical and selfish exactions of her mother. Poor old Mammy in particular, whose heart severed from all natural domestic ties, had consoled itself with this one beautiful being, was almost heartbroken. She cried day and night, and was, from excess of sorrow, less skillful and alert in her ministrations of her mistress than usual, which drew down a constant storm of invectives on her defenseless head. Miss Ophelia felt the loss, but in her good and honest heart it bore fruit unto everlasting life. She was more softened, more gentle, and though equally assiduous in every duty, it was with a chastened and quiet air, as one who communed with her own heart not in vain. She was more diligent in teaching Topsy, taught her mainly from the Bible, did not any longer shrink from her touch or manifest an ill-repressed disgust, because she felt none. She viewed her now through the softened medium that Eva's hand had first held before her eyes, and saw in her only an immortal creature, whom God had sent to be led by her in glory and virtue. Topsy did not become at once a saint, but the life and death of Eva did work a marked change in her. The callous indifference was gone. There was now sensibility, hope, desire, and the striving for good, a strife irregular, interrupted, suspended oft, but yet renewed again. One day, when Topsy had been sent for by Miss Ophelia, she came, hastily thrusting something into her bosom. "What are you doing there, you limb? You've been stealing something. I'll be bound," said the imperious little Rosa, who had been sent to call her, seizing her, at the same time, roughly by the arm. "You go along, Miss Rosa," said Topsy, pulling from her. "'Tain't none of your business."
"None of your set," said Rosa. "I saw you hiding something. I know your tricks."
And Rosa seized her arm and tried to force her hand into her bosom, while Topsy, in rage, kicked and fought valiantly for what she considered her rights. The clamour and confusion of the battle drew Miss Ophelia and St. Clair both to the spot. "She's been stealing," said Rosa.
"I hain't neither," vociferated Topsy, sobbing with passion. "Give me that, whatever it is," said Miss Ophelia firmly.
Topsy hesitated, but on a second order pulled out of her bosom a little parcel done up in the foot of one of her own old stockings. Miss Ophelia turned it out. There was a small book, which had been given to Topsy by Eva, containing a single verse of scripture, arranged for every day in the year, and in a paper the curl of hair that she had given her on that memorable day when she had taken her last farewell. St. Clair was a good deal affected at the sight of it. The little book had been rolled in a long strip of black crepe, torn from the funeral weeds.
"What did you wrap this around the book for?" said St. Clair, holding up the crepe.
"'Cause it was Miss Eva's." "Oh, don't take him away, please," she said, and sitting flat down on the floor and putting her apron over her head, she began to sob vehemently.
It was a curious mixture of the pathetic and the ludicrous, the little old stockings, black crepe, textbook, fair, soft curl, and Topsy's utter distress. St. Clair smiled, but there were tears in his eyes, as he said, "Come, come, don't cry, and you shall have them." And putting them together, he threw them into her lap, and drew Miss Ophelia with him into the parlour. "I really think you can make something of that concern," he said, pointing with his thumb backward over his shoulder. "Any mind that is capable of a real sorrow is capable of good. You must try and do something with her." "The child has improved greatly," said Miss Ophelia. "I have great hopes of her, but Augustine," she said, laying her hand on his arm. "One thing I want to ask. Whose is this child to be, yours or mine?" "Why, I gave her to you," said Augustine. "But not legally." "I want her to be mine, legally," said Miss Ophelia.
"Whew, cousin,"
said Augustine.
"What will the abolitionist society think? They'll have a day of fasting appointed for this backsliding, if you become a slaveholder?"
"Oh, nonsense. I want her mine that I might have a right to take her to the free states and give her her liberty. That all I am trying to do be not undone." "Oh, cousin, what an awful doing evil that good may come. I can't encourage it." "I don't want you to choke, but to reason," said Miss Ophelia. "There is no use in my trying to make this child a Christian child unless I save her from all the chances and reverses of slavery. And if you really are willing I should have her, I want you to give me a deed of gift, or some legal paper."
"Well, well," said St. Clair, "I will." And he sat down and unfolded a newspaper to read.
"But I want it done now," said Miss Ophelia.
"What's your hurry?"
"Because now is the only time there ever is to do a thing in," said Miss Ophelia. Come now. Here's a paper, pen, and ink. Just write a paper.
St. Clair, like most men of his class of mind, cordially hated the present tense of action, generally, and therefore he was considerably annoyed by Miss Ophelia's downrightness.
"Why, what's the matter?" said he. "Can't you take my word? One would think you had taken lessons of the Jews, coming at a fellow so."
"I want to make sure of it," said Miss Ophelia. "You may die.
Or fail, and then Topsy be hustled off to auction, spite of all I can do."
"Really, you are quite provident. Well,
seeing I'm in the hands of a Yankee, there is nothing for it but to concede." And St. Clair rapidly wrote off a deed of gift, which, as he was well versed in the forms of law, he could easily do, and signed his name to it in sprawling capitals, concluding by a tremendous flourish.
"There, isn't that black and white now, Miss Vermont?" he said as he handed it to her.
"Good boy," said Miss Ophelia, smiling. "But must it not be witnessed?"
"Oh, bother,
yes." "Here," he said, opening the door into Marie's apartment. "Marie, cousin wants your autograph. Just put your name down there."
"What's this?" said Marie, as she ran over the paper.
"Ridiculous! I thought cousin was too pious for such horrid things," she added, as she carelessly wrote her name. "But if she has a fancy for that article, I am sure she's welcome."
"There. Now she's yours, body and soul," said St. Clair, handing the paper.
"No more mine now than she was before," said Miss Ophelia. "Nobody but God has a right to give her to me, but I can protect her now."
"Well, she's yours by a fiction of law, then," said St. Clair, as he turned back into the parlour and sat down to his paper.
Miss Ophelia, who seldom sat much in Marie's company, followed him into the parlour, having first carefully laid away the paper.
"Augustine," she said suddenly, as she sat knitting,
"have you ever made any provision for your servants in case of your death?"
"No," said St. Clair, as he read on. "Then all your indulgence to them may prove a great cruelty by and by." St. Clair had often thought the same thing himself, but he answered negligently, "Well, I mean to make a provision by and by."
"When?" said Miss Ophelia.
"Oh, one of these days."
"What if you should die first?"
"Cousin, what's the matter?" said St. Clair, laying down his paper and looking at her. "Do you think I show symptoms of yellow fever or cholera, that you are making post-mortem arrangements with such zeal?"
"In the midst of life we are in death," said Miss Ophelia.
St. Clair rose up and, laying the paper down carelessly, walked to the door that stood open on the veranda to put an end to a conversation that was not agreeable to him. Mechanically he repeated the last word again, death. And as he leaned against the railings and watched the sparkling water as it rose and fell in the fountain, and as in a dim and dizzy haze saw flowers and trees and vases of the courts, he repeated again the mystic word so common in every mouth, yet of such fearful power, death. "Strange that there should be such a word," he said, "and such a thing. And we ever forget it, that one should be living, warm and beautiful, full of hopes, desires and wants one day, and the next be gone, utterly, gone and forever." It was a warm golden evening, and as he walked to the other end of the veranda, he saw Tom, busily intent on his Bible, pointing as he did so with his finger to each successive word, and whispering them to himself with an earnest air. "Want me to read to you, Tom?" said St. Clair, seating himself carelessly by him.
"If Massa pleases," said Tom gratefully, "Massa makes it so much plainer."
St. Clair took the book and glanced at the place, and began reading one of the passages which Tom had designated by the heavy marks around it. It ran as follows. "When the Son of Man shall come in his glory, and all his holy angels with him, then shall he sit upon the throne of his glory, and before him shall be gathered all nations, and he shall separate them one from another, as a shepherd divideth his sheep from the goats." St. Clair read on in an animated voice till he came to the last of the verses. "Then shall the king say unto him on his left hand, Depart from me, ye cursed, into everlasting fire. For I was an hungered, and ye gave me no meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me not in. Naked, and ye clothed me not. I was sick, and in prison, and ye visited me not. Then shall they answer unto him, Lord, when saw we thee an hungered, or at thirst, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not minister unto thee? Then shall he say unto them, Inasmuch as ye did it not to one of the least of these my brethren, ye did it not to me." St. Clair seemed struck with this last passage, for he read it twice, the second time slowly, and as if he were revolving the words in his mind. "Tom," he said, "these folks that get such hard measure seem to have been doing just what I have said, living good, easy, respectable lives, and not troubling themselves to inquire how many of their brethren were hungry or at thirst, or sick or in prison." Tom did not answer. St. Clair rose up and walked thoughtfully up and down the veranda, seeming to forget everything in his own thoughts, so absorbed was he
that Tom had to remind him twice that the tea bell had rung before he could get his attention.
St. Clair was absent and thoughtful all tea time.
After tea, he and Marie and Miss Ophelia took possession of the parlor almost in silence.
Marie disposed herself on a lounge under a silken mosquito curtain, and was soon sound asleep. Miss Ophelia silently busied herself with her knitting. St. Clair sat down to the piano and began playing a soft and melancholy movement with the Aeolian accompaniment. He seemed in a deep reverie, and to be soliloquizing to himself by music. After a little he opened one of the drawers, took out an old music book whose leaves were yellow with age, and began turning it over.
"There," he said to Miss Ophelia, "this was one of my mother's books, and here is her handwriting. Come and look at it." She copied and arranged this from Mozart's Requiem. Miss Ophelia came accordingly. "It was something she used to sing often," said St. Clair. "I think I can hear her now." He struck a few majestic chords and began singing that grand old Latin piece, the Dies Irae. Tom, who was listening in the outer veranda, was drawn by the sound to the very door, where he stood earnestly. He did not understand the words, of course, but the music and manner of singing appeared to affect him strongly, especially when St. Clair sang the more pathetic parts. Tom would have sympathized more heartily if he had known the meaning of the beautiful words.
Recordare, Jesus pie, quod sum cosa tuar vie, nimi perdas illa die, quarens misidista lasus, redemptista crucem passus, tantus labor non sit casus.
Think, O Jesus, for what reason thou endurest earth's spite and treason, nor me lose in that dread season, seeking me, thy worn feet hasted. On the cross thy soul death tasted. Let not all these toils be wasted.
St. Clair threw a deep and pathetic expression into the words, but the shadowy veil of years seemed drawn away, and he seemed to hear his mother's voice leading his. Voice and instrument seemed both living, and threw out with vivid sympathy those strains which the ethereal Mozart first conceived as his own dying requiem. When St. Clair had done singing, he sat leaning his head upon his hand a few moments, and then began walking up and down the floor.
"What a sublime conception is that of a last judgment," said he, "a righting of all the wrongs of ages, a solving of all moral problems, by an unanswerable wisdom. It is, indeed, a wonderful image."
"It is a fearful one to us," said Miss Ophelia.
"It ought to be to me, I suppose," said St. Clair, stopping, thoughtfully. "I was reading to Tom this afternoon that chapter in Matthew that gives an account of it, and I have been quite struck. One should have expected some terrible enormities charged to those who are excluded from heaven as the reason. But no, they are condemned for not doing positive good, as if that included every possible harm."
"Perhaps," said Miss Ophelia, "it is impossible for a person who does no good not to do harm."
"And what," said St. Clair, speaking abstractedly, but with deep feeling, "what shall be said of one whose own heart, whose education, and the wants of society have called in vain to some noble purpose, who has floated on a dreamy, neutral spectator of the struggles, agonies, and wrongs of man, when he should have been a worker?"
"I should say," said Miss Ophelia, "that he ought to repent and begin now."
"Always practical and to the point," said St. Clair, his face breaking out into a smile. "You never leave me any time for general reflections, cousin. You always bring me short up against the actual present. You have a kind of eternal now, always in your mind."
"Now is all the time I have anything to do with," said Miss Ophelia.
"Dear little Eva, poor child," said St. Clair. "She had set her little simple soul on a good work for me."
It was the first time since Eva's death that he had ever said as many words as these to her, and he spoke now evidently repressing very strong feeling.
"My view of Christianity is such," he added, "that I think no man can consistently profess it without throwing the whole weight of his being against this monstrous system of injustice that lies at the foundation of all our society, and if need be, sacrificing himself in the battle. That is, I mean that I could not be a Christian otherwise, though I have certainly had intercourse with a great many enlightened and Christian people who did no such thing, and I confess that the apathy of religious people on this subject, their want of perception of wrongs that filled me with horror, have engendered in me more skepticism than any other thing."
"If you knew all this," said Miss Ophelia, "why didn't you do it?"
"Because I had only that kind of benevolence which consists in lying on a sofa and cursing the church and clergy for not being martyrs and confessors. One can see, you know, very easily how others ought to be martyrs."
"Well, are you going to do differently now?" said Miss Ophelia.
"God only knows the future," said St. Clair. "I am braver than I was, because I have lost all, and he who has nothing to lose can afford all risks."
"And what are you going to do?"
"My duty, I hope, to the poor and lowly, as fast as I find it out," said St. Clair,
beginning with my own servants, for whom I have yet done nothing, and perhaps at some future day it may appear that I can do something for a whole class, something to save my country from the disgrace of that false position in which she now stands before all civilized nations.
"Do you suppose it possible that a nation ever will voluntarily emancipate?" said Miss Ophelia.
"I don't know," said St. Clair. "This is a day of great deeds.
Heroism and disinterestedness are rising up here and there in the earth. The Hungarian nobles set free millions of serfs at an immense pecuniary loss. And perhaps among us may be found generous spirits who do not estimate honor and justice by dollars and cents."
"I hardly think so," said Miss Ophelia.
"But suppose we should rise up tomorrow and emancipate. Who would educate these millions and teach them how to use their freedom? They never would rise to do much among us. The fact is, we are too lazy and unpractical ourselves ever to give them much of an idea of that industry and energy which is necessary to form them into men. They will have to go north, where labor is the fashion, the universal custom, and tells me now, is there enough Christian philanthropy among your northern states to bear with the process of their education and elevation? You send thousands of dollars to foreign missions, but could you endure to have the heathen sent into your towns and villages and give your time and thoughts and money to raise them to the Christian standard? That's what I want to know. If we emancipate, are you willing to educate? How many families in your town would take a Negro man and woman, teach them, bear with them, and seek to make them Christians? How many merchants would take Adolf if I wanted to make him a clerk? A Rosa to a school? How many schools are there in the northern states that would take them in? How many families that would board them? And yet they are as white as many a woman, north or south. You see, cousin, I want justice done us. We are in a bad position. We are the more obvious oppressors of the Negro. But the unchristian prejudice of the north is an oppressor almost equally severe.
Well, cousin, I know it is so, said Miss Ophelia. I know it was so with me till I saw that it was my duty to overcome it. But I trust I have overcome it, and I know there are many good people at the north who in this matter need only to be taught what their duty is to do it. It would certainly be a greater self-denial to receive heathen among us than to send missionaries to them, but I think we should do it.
You would, I know, said St. Clair. I'd like to see anything you wouldn't do if you thought it your duty.
Well, I'm not uncommonly good, said Miss Ophelia. Others would if they saw things as I do.
Besides, I know there are many people at the north who do exactly what you said.
Yes, but they are a minority.
And if we begin to emancipate at any extent, we should soon hear from you.
Miss Ophelia did not reply. There was a pause of some moments, and St. Clair's countenance was overcast by a sad, dreamy expression.
I don't know what makes me think of my mother so much tonight, he said. I have a strange kind of feeling as if she were near me. I keep thinking of things she used to say. Strange. What brings these past things so vividly back to us sometimes?
St. Clair walked up and down the room for some minutes more and then said, I believe I'll go down street a few moments and hear the news tonight. He took his hat and passed out.
Tom followed him to the passage out of the court and asked if he should attend him.
No, my boy, said St. Clair. I shall be back in an hour.
Tom sat down in the veranda. It was a beautiful moonlight evening, and he sat watching the rising and falling spray of the fountain and listening to its murmur. Tom thought of his home, and that he should soon be a free man and able to return to it at will. He thought how he should work to buy his wife and boys. He felt the muscles of his brawny arms with a sort of joy, as he thought they would soon belong to himself, and how much they could do to work out the freedom of his family. Then he thought of his noble young master, and every second to that came the habitual prayer that he had always offered for him, and then his thoughts passed on to the beautiful Eva, whom he now thought of among the angels. And he thought till he almost fancied that the bright face and golden hair were looking upon him, out of the spray of the fountain. And so musing he fell asleep, and dreamed he saw her coming bounding towards him, just as she used to come, with a wreath of jessamine in her hair, her cheeks bright, and her eyes radiant with delight. But as he looked she seemed to rise from the ground. Her cheeks wore a paler hue, her eyes had a deep divine radiance, a golden halo seemed around her head, and she vanished from his sight, and Tom was awakened by a loud knocking, and a sound of many voices at the gate. He hastened to undo it, and with smothered voices and heavy tread came several men bringing a body, wrapped in a cloak and lying on a shutter. The light of the lamp fell full on the face, and Tom gave a wild cry of amazement and despair that rung through all the galleries as the men advanced with their burden to the open parlor door where Miss Ophelia still sat knitting. St. Clair had turned into a café to look over an evening paper, as he was reading in a fray rose between two gentlemen in the room, who were both partially intoxicated. St. Clair and one or two others made an effort to separate them, and St. Clair received a fatal stab in the side with a bowie knife, which he was attempting to wrest from one of them. The house was full of cries and lamentations, shrieks and screams, servants frantically tearing their hair, throwing themselves on the ground, or running distractedly about, lamenting,
Tom and Miss Ophelia alone seemed to have any presence of mind, for Marie was in strong hysteric convulsions. At Miss Ophelia's direction, one of the lounges in the parlour was hastily prepared, and the bleeding form laid upon it. St. Clair had fainted, through pain and loss of blood, but as Miss Ophelia applied restoratives, he revived, opened his eyes, looked fixedly on them, looked earnestly around the room, his eyes travelling wistfully over every object, and finally they rested on his mother's picture. The physician now arrived and made his examination. It was evident, from the expression of his face, that there was no hope, but he applied himself to dressing the wound, and he and Miss Ophelia and Tom proceeded composedly with this work, amid the lamentations and sobs and cries of the affrighted servants, who had clustered about the doors and windows of the veranda. "Now," said the physician, "we must turn all these creatures out. All depends on his being kept quiet." St. Clair opened his eyes and looked fixedly on the distressed beings, whom Miss Ophelia and the doctor were trying to urge from the apartment. "Poor creatures," he said, and an expression of bitter self-reproach passed over his face. Adolf absolutely refused to go. Terror had deprived him of all presence of mind. He threw himself along the floor, and nothing could persuade him to rise. The rest yielded to Miss Ophelia's urgent representations, that their master's safety depended on their stillness and obedience. St. Clair could say but little. He lay with his eyes shut, but it was evident that he rested with bitter thoughts. After a while he laid his hand on Tom's, who was kneeling beside him, and said, "Tom, poor fellow." "What, massa?" said Tom earnestly. "I am dying," said St. Clair, pressing his hand. "Pray." "If you would like a clergyman," said the physician. St. Clair hastily shook his head, and said again to Tom, more earnestly, "Pray." And Tom did pray, with all his mind and strength, for the soul that was passing, the soul that seemed looking so steadily and mournfully from those large melancholy blue eyes. It was literally prayer offered with strong crying and tears. When Tom ceased to speak, St. Clair reached out and took his hand, looking earnestly at him, but saying nothing. He closed his eyes, but still retained his hold, for in the gates of eternity the black hand and the white hold each other with an equal clasp. He murmured softly to himself at broken intervals. "Ricordare Jesu pie, ni mi perdas illa die, quaresmi sedisti lassus." It was evident that the words he had been singing that evening were passing through his mind, words of entreaty addressed to infinite pity. His lips moved at intervals as parts of the hymn fell brokenly from them.
"His mind is wandering," said the doctor.
"No, it is coming home at last," said St. Clair energetically. "At last, at last!"
The effort of speaking exhausted him. The sinking paleness of death fell on him. But with it there fell, as if shed from the wings of some pitying spirit, a beautiful expression of peace, like that of a weary child who sleeps. So he lay for a few moments. They saw that the mighty hand was on him. Just before the spirit parted, he opened his eyes with a sudden light, as of joy and recognition, and said, "Mother!" And then he was gone.
Chapter 29. The Unprotected. We hear often of the distress of the negro servants on the loss of a kind master, and with good reason. For no creature on God's earth is left more utterly unprotected and desolate than the slave in these circumstances. The child who has lost a father has still the protection of friends and of the law. He is something, and can do something, has acknowledged rights and position. The slave has none. The law regards him, in every respect, as devoid of rights, as a bale of merchandise. The only possible acknowledgment of any of the longings and wants of a human and a mortal creature, which are given to him, comes to him through the sovereign and irresponsible will of his master. And when that master is stricken down, nothing remains. The number of those men who know how to use wholly irresponsible power humanely and generously is small. Everybody knows this, and the slave knows it best of all. So that he feels that there are 10 chances of his finding an abusive and tyrannical master to 1 of his finding a considerate and kind one. Therefore, it is that the wail over a kind master is loud and long, as well it may be. When St. Clair breathed his last, terror and consternation took hold of all his household. He had been stricken down so in a moment, in the flower and strength of his youth. Every room and gallery of the house resounded with sobs and shrieks of despair. Marie, whose nervous system had been enervated by a constant course of self-indulgence, had nothing to support the terror of the shock, and at the time her husband breathed his last, was passing from one fainting fit to another, and he to whom she had been joined in the mysterious tie of marriage passed from her forever, without the possibility of even a parting word. Miss Ophelia, with characteristic strength and self-control, had remained with her kinsman to the last, all eye, all ear, all attention, doing everything of the little that could be done, and joining with her whole soul in the tender and impassioned prayers which the poor slave had poured forth for the soul of his dying master. When they were arranging him for his last rest, they found upon his bosom a small, plain, miniature case, opening with a spring. It was the miniature of a noble and beautiful female face, and on the reverse, under a crystal, a lock of dark hair. They laid them back on the lifeless breast, dust to dust, poor mournful relics of early dreams, which once made that cold heart beat so warmly. Tom's whole soul was filled with thoughts of eternity, and while he ministered around the lifeless clay, he did not once think that the sudden stroke had left him in hopeless slavery. He felt at peace about his master, for in that hour, when he had poured forth his prayer into the bosom of his father, he had found an answer of quietness and assurance springing up within himself. In the depths of his own affectionate nature, he felt able to perceive something of the fullness of divine love. For an old oracle hath thus written, "He that dwelleth in love dwelleth in God, and God in him." Tom hoped and trusted and was at peace. But the funeral passed, with all its pageant of black crape and prayers, and solemn faces, and back rolled the cool, muddy waves of everyday life, and up came the everlasting hard inquiry of what is to be done next. It rose to the mind of Marie, as dressed in loose mourning robes, and surrounded by anxious servants, she sat up in a great easy chair, and inspected samples of crepe and bombazine. It rose to Miss Ophelia, who began to turn her thoughts towards her northern home. It rose in silent terrors to the minds of the servants, who well knew the unfeeling tyrannical character of the mistress in whose hands they were left. All knew very well that the indulgence which had been accorded to them were not from their mistress, but from their master, and that now he was gone. There would be no screen between them, and every tyrannous infliction which a temper scoured by affliction might devise. It was about a fortnight after the funeral that Miss Ophelia, busied one day in her apartment, heard a gentle tap at the door. She opened it, and there stood Rosa, the pretty young quadroon, whom we have before often noticed, her hair in disorder, and her eyes swelled with crying. "Oh, Miss Feely," she said, falling on her knees, and catching the skirt of her dress, do go to Miss Marie for me. Do plead for me. She's going to send me out to be whipped. Look there." And she handed to Miss Ophelia a paper. It was an order, written in Marie's delicate Italian hand, to the master of a whipping establishment, to give the bearer 15 lashes. "What have you been doing?" said Miss Ophelia. "You know, Miss Feely, I've got such a bad temper. It's very bad of me. I was trying on Miss Marie's dress, and she slapped my face, and I spoke out before I thought, and was saucy, and she said that she'd bring me down, and have me know once for all that I wasn't going to be so toppin' as I had been. And she wrote this, and says I shall carry it. I'd rather she'd kill me, right out." Miss Ophelia stood considering, with the paper in her hand. "You see, Miss Feely," said Rosa, "I don't mind the whipping so much, if Miss Marie, or you, was to do it. But to be sent to a man, and such a horrid man. The shame of it, Miss Feely." Miss Ophelia well knew that it was the universal custom to send women and young girls to whipping houses, to the hands of the lowest of men, men vile enough to make this their profession, there to be subjected to brutal exposure and shameful correction. She had known it before, but hitherto she had never realized it till she saw the slender form of Rosa almost convulsed with distress. All the honest blood of womanhood, the strong New England blood of liberty, flushed to her cheeks and throbbed bitterly in her indignant heart. But with habitual prudence and self-control, she mastered herself, and crushing the paper firmly in her hand, she merely said to Rosa, "Sit down, child, while I go to your mistress." "Shameful, monstrous, outrageous," she said to herself as she was crossing the parlor. She found Marie sitting up in her easy chair, with Mammy standing by her, combing her hair. Jane sat on the ground before her, busy in chafing her feet. "How do you find yourself today?" said Miss Ophelia. A deep sigh and a closing of the eyes was the only reply. For a moment, and then Marie answered, "Oh, I don't know, cousin. I suppose I'm as well as I ever shall be." And Marie wiped her eyes with a cambric handkerchief, bordered with an inch deep of black. "I came," said Miss Ophelia, with a short, dry cough, such as commonly introduces a difficult subject. "I came to speak with you about poor Rosa." Marie's eyes were open wide enough now, and a flush rose to her sallow cheeks as she answered sharply, "Well, what about her?"
"She is very sorry for her fault."
"She is she?"
"She'll be sorrier before I've done with her.
I've endured that child's impudence long enough, and now I'll bring her down.
I'll make her lie in the dust." "But could you not punish her some other way? Some way that would be less shameful?"
"I mean to shame her. That's just what I want. She has all her life presumed on her delicacy and her good looks and her ladylike airs till she forgets who she is, and I'll give her one lesson that will bring her down, I fancy.
But, cousin, consider that. If you destroy delicacy and a sense of shame in a young girl, you deprave her very fast."
"Delicacy," said Marie, with a scornful laugh. "Huh, a fine word for such as she. I'll teach her, with all her airs, that she's no better than the raggedest black wench that walks the streets. She'll take no more airs with me."
"You will answer to God for such cruelty," said Miss Ophelia, with energy.
"Cruelty? I'd like to know what that cruelty is. I wrote orders for only 15 lashes, and told him to put them on lightly. I'm sure there's no cruelty there."
"No cruelty," said Miss Ophelia. "I'm sure any girl might rather be killed outright."
"It might seem so to anybody with your feeling, but all these creatures get used to it. It's the only way they can be kept in order. Once let them feel that they are to take any airs about delicacy and all that, and they'll run all over you, just as my servants always have. I've begun now to bring them under, and I'll have them all to know that I'll send one out to be whipped as soon as another, if they don't mind themselves," said Marie, looking around her decidedly.
Jane hung her head and cowered at this, for she felt as if it was particularly directed to her.
Miss Ophelia sat for a moment as if she had swallowed some explosive mixture and were ready to burst. Then, recollecting the utter uselessness of contention with such a nature, she shut her lips resolutely, gathered herself up, and walked out of the room. It was hard to go back and tell Rosa that she could do nothing for her, and shortly after one of the manservants came to say that her mistress had ordered him to take Rosa with him to the whipping-house, whither she was hurried in spite of her tears and entreaties. A few days after, Tom was standing musing by the balconies, when he was joined by Adolf, who since the death of his master had been entirely crestfallen and disconsolate. Adolf knew that he had always been an object of dislike to Marie, but while his master lived he had paid but little attention to it. Now that he was gone, he had moved about in daily dread and trembling, not knowing what might befall him next. Marie had held several consultations with her lawyer. After communicating with St. Clair's brother, it was determined to sell the place and all the servants, except her own personal property, and these she intended to take with her and go back to her father's plantation.
"Do you know, Tom, that we've all got to be sold?" said Adolf.
"How did you hear that?" said Tom. "I hid myself behind the curtains when Missus was talking with the lawyer. In a few days we shall be sent off to auction, Tom."
"The Lord's will be done," said Tom, folding his arms and sighing heavily.
"We'll never get another such a master," said Adolf apprehensively. "But I'd rather be sold than take my chance under Missus."
Tom turned away. His heart was full.
The hope of liberty, the thought of distant wife and children, rose up before his patient soul. As to the mariner shipwrecked almost in port, rises the vision of the church spire and loving roofs of his native villages, seen over the top of some black wave only for one last farewell. He drew his arms tightly over his bosom and choked back the bitter tears and tried to pray. Poor old soul had such a singular, unaccountable prejudice in favor of liberty that it was a hard wrench for him, and the more he said, "Thy will be done," the worse he felt. He sought Miss Ophelia, who ever since Eva's death had treated him with marked and respectful kindness.
"Miss Feely," he said, "Master St. Clair promised me my freedom. He told me that he had begun to take it out for me, and now, perhaps, if Miss Feely would be good enough to speak about it to Missus, she would feel like going on with it. But it was as Master St. Clair's wish."
"I'll speak for you, Tom, and do my best," said Miss Ophelia. "But if it depends on Mrs. St. Clair, I can't hope much for you. Nevertheless, I will try." This incident occurred a few days after that of Rosa, while Miss Ophelia was busied in preparations to return north.
Seriously reflecting within herself, she considered that perhaps she had shown too hasty a warmth of language in her former interview with Marie, and she resolved that she would now endeavor to moderate her zeal and to be as conciliatory as possible. So the good soul gathered herself up and, taking her knitting, resolved to go into Marie's room, be as agreeable as possible, and negotiate